This podcast contains topics related to crime, death, and domestic violence and may contain strong language. Listener discretion is advised. Lauren.
This is Brian.
And this is the City of Brotherly Blood, Episode 1. So after a lot of research and many spirited discussions, we're ready for our maiden voyage. Basically, since young childhood, I was bred with a fascination of the horror genre. My vivid memories really begin in my cousin's basement, and I'm mulling over a library of VHS tapes recorded with all these scary movies, and I just watch them unblinking, totally unfazed. And for me, the love of these films have really stood the test of time. So in recent years, it only seemed like a natural progression that I would find my way into the world of true crime and try to come to terms with the reality that horror does exist in our world, and sometimes on an incomprehensible level. Enter my partner in crime and in life, Brian.
Hello.
Who is essentially the polar opposite of a horror fan, but out of love supports the habit, and out of a much more refined knowledge of sound media and recording actually enables this podcast.
Woo-woo.
So thanks, Brian.
You're welcome.
Making my dreams a reality.
Hey, anything for you.
So the original plan was to do a broad sweep of lesser-known true crime stories, and that really did prove to hold plenty of content. But the scarier realization when we talked about it was that as Philadelphia natives, or Brian being a suburb native,
hey.
Sorry to out you, but we realized that Philly does really have a rich history of crime, so we narrowed our scope and got to work. Today we're kicking off with a case that predates us. We're both 80s babies, though that makes this case no less terrifying. This is the case of the unicorn killer, Ira Einhorn. And just a fun fact, they call him the unicorn killer not because he's a mythical creature, but only because his surname in German means one horn.
Hmm. Interesting.
Right. So like many of his breed who are equally as charismatic, Ira was smart, charming, and had a penchant for violence. Ira was born in May of 1940 in Philadelphia to Joseph and B. Einhorn. They were a middle-class Jewish couple. His father, Joseph, was soft-spoken and gentle. He was a second-generation Russian immigrant who inherited a modest fruit business from his father. B., his mother, was the much more assertive of the two. She was the daughter of native Philadelphians, so she was used to the city. And she was also used to a very financially comfortable lifestyle, though she had no problems working for those means. B was a go-getter, and she worked in the days of the Depression as a typist for the firm of Dunn and Bradstreet. She quickly worked her way to the head of her department. As for her husband, B decided that his earning potential was not really being harnessed in the fruit business. There was not a whole lot of money to be had in selling bananas and apples, apparently. So she steered him towards a job in what was called the installment business. And what we gathered was that that's basically the birth of a credit card. So what would happen was Joe would actually hold the merchandise. It was anything from furniture to a piece of jewelry. And a customer that was of very humble means would give him an installment payment and then several installments thereafter. And in the end, they were basically paying way more than the item was worth. So Joe was making out on the deal. And with this dual income hustle, Joe and B did pretty well for themselves, and they retained a residence near Broad and Olney. And it was at that time, I guess they were ready to start a family.
Before we talk about the family.
Yes.
Broad and, isn't it Olney?
Oh my goodness.
I know I'm the suburb guy, but it's Olney. You city folk.
Semantics.
All right. Well, after 5 years of marriage, in May of 1940, the two welcomed a son, Ira Samuel. B left her job to take care of this little baby boy. When the country went to war, Joe suffered numerous health woes and was given a deferment. Unfortunately, though, he lost his business and was assigned to work in the shipyard, which also proved to be too physically difficult after the ailment that he was suffering. Joe ultimately landed in a defense position as a cab driver, which, with a love of cars, suited him well. After the war, Joe kept up a robust living dealing used cars, and B would keep the books. Now, you might be expecting that this is where we insert the clear bad upbringing Ira had to have had leading up to his acts of violence, but you might be surprised to find that B was absolutely smitten with Ira. She was a doting mother who always sang his praises. From the start, Ira was a clearly gifted child who consumed books regularly and who, with B's rigorous teaching, was roughly at a third grade level as a preschooler.
B also said that Ira learned how to play bridge just by watching her at a ridiculously young age, something like 7 or 8, and that her bridge partners would want to be challenged by Ira. I think that's quite ridiculous.
That's pretty insane. I think that speaks more to how much B was playing bridge during those times.
I gotta be honest, I don't even really know what bridge is. So the fact that a 7 or 8 year old is playing it, I think that's just enough to impress me right then and there.
If it's not Candyland.
If it's not Candyland.
I don't know what they're
kick ass at. I don't wanna know about bridge.
All right. Well, 4 years after the Bridge Master was born, Joe and B gave Ira a sibling, a baby boy named Steven. Steve was perceived to be less of a powerhouse than his big brother, and he was said to have experienced quite a bit of illness as a child.
Yeah, Steven, unfortunately, as outsiders would say, was not the favorite child. B taught Ira quite a bit, and it seemed like it was an effect of the heir and the spare, the firstborn versus the second born afterthought that's just kind of there as a backup.
That's what I gather. I don't mean to bring this up right now, but you know,
you're the
firstborn and I'm the secondborn. So everything you're saying right now is pretty messed up.
Opinion.
Oh my God. Well, as impressive as Ira's intellect was, it led to a predictable path of boredom when he did begin kindergarten at 5 years old. Despite teachers' desires to skip him 2 or 3 grades, Joseph expressed concerns and ultimately decided to keep him at the age-appropriate level. Ira was frustrated. He was disruptive in class. Often, he was being scolded for being loud, getting out of a seat, and wandering around the classroom. All those things that you'd expect, like, the class clown to do. But at the same time, his academic marks were soaring. His behavior, less stellar. This pattern of intelligence and disregard for proper classroom conduct continued through a move to West Oak Lane, a northwest part of Philadelphia, and during his adolescence when Ira entered Central High, a college prep high school. It was reserved for only students with exceptional academic scores. But I have to say, he did get in there a year younger than most of his, you know, I guess, peers.
Right. I'm unsure whether they did eventually skip Ira when he was in elementary school. They say that he started a year younger than pretty much everybody else, so possibly during the course of 1 through 8, he was skipped a grade. And it was in Central High that Ira finally dared to be outwardly different. He still excelled academically, but he started to express some independent thinking. He challenged his teachers and even dressed unlike anyone his age. Now, this is something of note in the history books of Ira Einhorn.
This is probably the best thing of note about Ira Einhorn.
I'm telling you, you need to listen in closely. Ira was the first person in his neighborhood to wear Bermuda shorts.
Get right out of town.
I'm telling you.
Shorts.
That is written in books as a notable part of Ira's life.
The original Jimmy Buffett.
Pioneer. You heard it here first.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Are Bermuda shorts the thing that bring people down? That's it.
We're beginning a research study right here and now. If you want to be a participant, you have worn Bermuda shorts and your life has gone terribly wrong, please contact us. But anyway, getting back to Ira. Ira, he actually became not only a scholar-like figure at Central High, but also a jock. He bulked up and played football, which to everyone's account who went to school with him was pretty impressive because he was kind of twerpy and just by his own volition hit the gym and became this behemoth monster that ran downfield and scored touchdowns.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I just, after doing this research about Ira, like, I can't imagine him ever saying, like, yo, I'm hitting the gym.
Sorry.
Gaines all day, people.
Oh, it'd be so fun.
He was taking gym mirror selfies. You're going to hear that he was the first to do that, too. But by his senior year, Ira had established himself as something of a walking contradiction. He was jock, he was scholar, he continued to push boundaries. He even created a stir at his senior prom by showing up in jeans.
Badass.
That was something that actually kept him from, well, almost kept him from graduating, because people were so appalled that he showed up in such casual attire that his teachers were like, Ira, you might not be walking down that aisle and collecting your diploma.
Because you look like Pony Boy.
He probably wanted to look like Pony Boy, let's be honest. And in a strange foreshadowing, B, Ira's mom, actually had repeated something proudly that the teacher told her before Ira's rebellious ways almost cost him graduation. The teacher said, I ought to wring that boy's neck, but I cannot deny the world Ira. I feel like that line itself is so problematic because it shows how much reinforcement he was getting from such a young age. Teachers wanting to skip him several years ahead. Teachers basically saying the world cannot live without Ira.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you figure these teachers are looking at a kid who is brilliant and going, oh my God, I hope he does everything he's capable of doing. In the right way.
Exactly.
And you're never expecting, I mean, the most brilliant people in the world can be the most, you know, nasty, aggressive people. Right. They're so smart that they know what to do.
I just think in the wrong hands, too much positive reinforcement can create a narcissistic monster.
Absolutely.
And you will learn that's what happens with Ira.
Yeah.
Ira, no surprise, went on to attend the University of Pennsylvania in 1957.
If you're not from like around here, that is a super prestigious school.
It is Ivy League all the way. Shout out to my Penn alum, because I have quite a few. I know you guys are smarty pants. Anyway, at Penn, according to his friend Mel Richter, Ira had declared, quote, an open warfare on conventionality. He did pledge a prestigious fraternity and successfully completed Hell Week, but once he observed all the typical frat antics, he decided it was beneath him and completely bounced. I don't know what the frat antics were. I just have to assume it was like keg stands, pantsing people.
Oh, I've seen Animal House.
All things that were way below Ira's intelligence level.
They definitely sang Shout.
they may have sang Shout. And although he continued to read dutifully, he mostly self-taught his way through Penn. He was only really moved by his literature professor. The professor was named Morse Peckham, by the way.
Oh my God.
That is a great name.
That is the best name said on a podcast in 2019.
I think
Morse
it is.
Peckham.
It wins the award.
Peckham. I hardly knew.
That's what he said. By the time Ira was getting ready to finish up Penn, he guesstimated that he attended something like 5% of his classes and spent the rest of the time on reading, sex, and drugs. Those are some strong numbers right there. 5% attendance rate, 95% sex, drugs, rock and roll.
And then, you
slash
know,
reading.
Now we spend the rest of our lives paying back college debt for those.
I have to wonder what the college tuition was like at those times. I'm sure he got a scholarship. The professors generally passed Ira, even though he barely attended their classes, just based on his papers demonstrating that he mastered the subject. But unfortunately, one professor could not overlook his poor attendance and gave him a failing grade. At this point, B was horrified and responded by driving down to Penn's campus and trying to reason with the teacher.
My God, this fucking guy.
I can't believe that at 22 years old, you're letting mommy come down and argue your case for you.
Right? I mean, if the Bermuda shorts weren't enough, this is definitely enough to know that he was a total douche.
Right. And also, if he's on a warfare against conventionality, I don't think he could have strayed any farther in the opposite direction.
Yeah, right?
Mama's boy.
Oh, my God. Well, Ira did end up repeating that course in the summer. And despite Professor Peckham, God, it's fun to say, despite Professor Peckham's urging, he declined to go to grad school and spent the next several years traveling, consuming books on an obnoxious rate, and writing. In his travels, Ira not only dabbled in illicit drug use and sex with, to his estimation, catch this, 1,300 to 1,800 women.
That's
Hold on.
Pretty lofty figure right
like,
there.
Like, I'm trying to do the math, and, like, I'm pretty sure that's 3 a-days. He is racking in the numbers on this.
I think
and this is what he's telling the world. This is good.
I think he's pretty much like Creed Bratton, too. If you watch The Office, as Creed says, he participated in a lot of group sex. So there's no way of knowing if a male
snuck in there.
Yeah. One could have slipped in. There would be no way of knowing. So it could be a mixed bag in those 1,300 to 1,800.
All right. Now, although he was actively participating in, you know, these 1,300 to 1,800
sexual trysts.
Yes. He did have time to fall deeply in love with a woman from Bennington College. This lady was known as Rita.
He was writing her tons of beautiful love poetry.
He was. And there was one in particular that I think, you know, if they ended up getting married, might have been one that would be passed down from generation to generation. It went something like this.
Hit me.
To kill what you love when you can't have it seems so natural that strangling Rita last night seemed so right. This dude had problems. Like, there's no doubt about it. All right.
Unfortunately, that piece of literature wasn't discovered till well after he ran into mightier problems.
Right? You know? Well, Ira's friend Michael Hoffman spoke of his violent mood swings. One in particular that sent a woman running hysterically away from his apartment. So there definitely were, you know, signs leading up to Ira's ultimate violent act.
His domestic abuse pattern.
Yeah, murder. Around age 25, Ira had established himself as a widely, you know, used term at the time. He was a counterculture icon. He even founded what was called the Free University, which offered courses like tantric sex and third world liberation.
Those go hand in hand, by the way.
Now, yeah, absolutely. I went to school for English, and people told me that, you know, there might not be a lot of jobs there
right at
the time. But I feel like if I went to his school, things could have really turned around.
It could have been like English / happy ending massages.
Oh, God.
Well, in the midst of him being this counterculture icon, Ira was hooked up with this lovely English undergrad at Penn named Judy. And he courted Judy for quite a while until Judy realized that Ira was probably not really her type. He was getting around. He was pigheaded. He was sexist. And she decided she was going to break up with him. That culminated in Ira whacking Judy over the head with a Coke bottle and rendering her unconscious. According to Judy, he also strangled her, but with her pleading, he decided he's going to spare her life and just fled. Since Judy didn't dare report this to the police, who at the time were widely considered to be pigs who accused women of provoking their attackers, Ira was undeterred on his path to become a household name in Philadelphia. He was an outspoken environmentalist, the MC at the city's first Earth Day, which, by the way, did you know that Philadelphia basically conceptualized Earth Day?
Represent.
Yeah, it was first celebrated in Philadelphia. And Ira did go on to say that he was one of the planners, creators, if you will, of Earth Day. He was not.
That makes more sense.
Somebody called BS on that claim.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
But Ira was friends with people in very high places. He was rubbing elbows with Abbie Hoffman, Peter Gabriel, believe it or not, and Jerry Garcia. In 1972, Ira was still holding audiences captive. He was at a local bistro called La Terrasse, where he often took up a lot of space, but never picked up the tab. It was there he met the striking beauty, the subject of our case, Holly Maddox. Now, I want to pause right here to talk about Holly for a second, because I think Brian and I have come to the realization that in discussing true crime, the victim of the crime often gets reduced to this one-dimensional figure that really isn't part of the story. And I want to say that Holly was, in her own right, an incredible woman. She was the salutatorian of her high school class, her graduating class. She was voted most likely to succeed. She was an athlete. She was a dancer, very creative. She used to draw and bake. And she got accepted to the prestigious Bryn Mawr College locally, which at the time was a liberal arts college for women. Holly was also a very avid environmentalist, and she did a lot of volunteer work. So it only took 2 weeks for Ira to charm Holly into moving into his shabby Ray Street apartment and strap in for a grueling 5-year relationship. Holly's sister Elizabeth recalls that there was no love lost between Ira and the Maddox family. Elizabeth recalls him coming to visit one time at their home in Tyler, Texas, and he ate like a caveman. He treated Holly like a maid, and this is the grossest story. During prayers before dinner one night, he was picking his poison ivy sores at the table. I think that's completely gross. And there have been accounts that Ira's hygiene was less than wonderful. Things were not much better for the couple back in Philly, where Ira assumed his dominant role in the relationship. His friend Keegan even told of a time where they were out and about, and Ira asked him, "Would you take Holly home? Because I'm going home with someone else." Holly and Ira were not in a happily open relationship, as far as we know, but she tolerated these things. It was only in 1977 that Holly finally gathered her self-respect and left Ira after devising a plan to start her own business, and she also met another man, a very charming lad named Saul Lapidus. After Holly shacked up with Saul and Ira realized she wasn't coming back, he called her completely livid and told her that he was going to toss her things into the street like trash if she didn't come back to fetch them. So Holly told Saul she was off to go grab her things, and she was never to be seen again. Anyone who called to ask Ira where Holly was, he claimed she went to the food co-op to get tofu and Brussels sprouts and never returned. That is quite an excuse.
And very specific.
Very specific. He had that devised. But Brian and I, we wrote a little note here after that, wondering where the heck Saul was in all of this. When he realized that Holly wasn't returning to his place several hours later the next day, did a red flag not go up in his head?
All right. Now, I get that Saul was in New York and, Ira's in Philly. So you figure Holly's got to go back to Philly a couple hours. But Saul was like, "Oh, yeah, your crazy-ass ex-boyfriend. Yeah, you can go grab your shit and come right back. That's cool." But when she doesn't come back, he's like, "Well, she's probably still at the co-op. Right. I don't know."
And Saul did give a report that he offered to go with Holly because he was a little bit concerned, especially with Ira's temper and his claims that he's going to trash all of her stuff. But Holly told Saul, He's going to have a shit fit if you come with me, and I'll be okay. So he let her go. But again, after not returning, several hours later, the next day, where were you, Saul? Come on now.
Better not call Saul.
Better not call Saul, that's right.
Well, Holly's parents didn't buy the story. Suspicious that Holly, who was usually in touch on a regular basis, says, you know, she was in Philly, they were in Texas. She had been out of contact for weeks and didn't even contact her mom on her birthday. With more than an inkling that Ira was to blame for something that was going on, they put two former FBI agents on the case to look into Ira.
Yeah, they were private investigators.
After interviewing a host of the couple's friends and neighbors, they gathered that another tenant had heard loud bangs and a blood-curdling scream around the same time that Holly disappeared. Weeks later, the same tenant reported a foul smell and brownish liquid seeping into the ceiling, which the landlord attempted to eradicate with no cooperation from Ira. Now, hold on. So the same guy is going to some authority and going like, I don't know, I heard some screaming. And then a couple days later going, now there's some stuff dripping from the ceiling.
So I think the story is that he was interviewed much after the fact. And somebody said, you know, did you see anything? Did you hear anything suspicious? And he was like, come to think of it, I did hear a blood-curdling scream the night that Holly disappeared. And he also said that weeks later, when he did see this brownish liquid coming through his ceiling, that the smell was so bad that his roommate actually was like, I'm out of here. I'm not living here anymore. But he stuck around trying to get rid of the smell, which to no avail.
Wow. Well, the PIs had finally assembled a neat case against Ira and delivered it to the police. By the time that Detective Michael Chitwood knocked on Ira's apartment door with a search warrant, it was nearly 18 months since Holly's disappearance. And that's just going to be a running, you know, a running theme. Yeah, in this case is that, like,
things moving at a glacial pace.
Things are moving so darn slow, and that's what make, you know, like, a guy like Ira, who is just a god-awful person, but also smart, it gives him the chance to get away. Like, it's just not, it's not good.
Well, unsurprisingly, when they entered Ira's apartment, Detective Chitwood and his accompanying officers made a beeline for a locked closet in Ira's apartment.
Oh, where that stuff was dripping from, I'm guessing. Yes.
The same general vicinity. Apparently, the closet was locked with a padlock, so they turned and asked Ira, do you have the keys? And he was like, no, I don't have the keys. So they broke it open, and they came upon a steamer trunk. When they opened the steamer trunk, they just found layers upon layers of old newspapers, random plastic bags, and styrofoam. When they peeled back these layers, they reached in and slowly pulled out a hand. And as they continued to pull, they uncovered the mummified body of a woman, which now weighed only about 37 pounds after over a year of decomposition. Detective Chitwood says that he turned to Ira and deadpan said, it looks like we found Holly. And Ira coolly replied, you found what you found. Now, I'm not sure, but that doesn't sound like the response of an innocent man. It sounds like the response of someone saying, yeah, I guess the jig is up.
Yeah.
But he'll go on to deny that he has anything to do with Holly's death. When the medical examiner investigated, they discovered that Holly suffered 6 blows to her head and died as a result of blunt force trauma. Needless to say, Ira was arrested, and he was released on bail to await his murder trial. Guess what the bail amount was? $4,000.
Wow.
So the bail was set at $40,000, and one of his friends, a Montreal socialite that had very deep pockets, easily put up the $4,000 to get him out. And never to back down from a challenge, Ira assured all of his shocked entourage that he had clearly been framed and that Holly was killed as something as a warning to Ira for just knowing too damn much. He He knew way too much about global conspiracies, government mind experimentations, and the like, paranormal information. All these things that Ira said he had insider information about. And the KGB, who else?
This is what sane people say.
Yeah. Somebody was after him because he had a wealth of information. And Ira also scoffed that he wouldn't be so stupid as to hide the body feet away from where he slept if he had in fact been the killer. But you would think that he would have smelt it, right? The trial, unfortunately, wouldn't unfold as seamlessly as law enforcement had hoped, because just days before it was set to begin in 1981, Ira fled.
And despite tireless pursuits by law enforcement internationally, Ira continued to evade the hold of justice. Ira scooted around Ireland, England, and Scotland with just the occasional threat of being apprehended. The same Montreal socialite who posted his bail, you know, that $40,000, she continued to wire him money through 1988. This fueled his escape into oblivion.
So for 7 years, a woman was literally wiring him money just to continue on this man-on-the-run lifestyle.
Ira was eventually directed to him, to the embrace of Annika Floden, who was a lovely Swedish woman with a rich family, pretty much the jackpot for Ira. Ira again dodged Swedish police, and the pair were on the move, finally.
And I want to insert here, too,
okay,
that the Swedish police actually said that Ira was living right under their noses the entire time because he was about 3 or 4 blocks from the police station.
Oh, God.
I think that's pretty incredible.
Oh, my God. See, you know, I guess you hide in plain sight.
Exactly.
Well, the two finally moved to the south of France where they built their own, quote, well, to quote Ira, their own touch of Eden. But I have to tell you, at this time, he was going by a different name. His name was Eugene Mallon, which...
sounds very French.
I guess.
Eugene Mallon, funnily enough, was just the name of a bookseller that Ira was acquainted with. So he took his name...
stolen identity.
Stolen identity with no regard that Eugene Mallon could possibly be arrested for murder at this point.
Oh. Well, meanwhile, back in Philly in 93, fearing that witnesses would become sparse, DA Lynn Abraham took advantage of a new state law allowing trials in absentia.
That basically means that the defendant doesn't have to be there to defend himself.
I'm happy so. You have friends that went to Penn.
And went to law school.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
It was only then, after 2 hours of jury deliberation, that Ira was convicted of first-degree murder. Now, I do have to say, this is 1993. How many years is that since he actually
16.
Killed her? 16. That's insane.
So 1977 is when he committed the crime, and it's not until 1993 that he's actually convicted of it.
But he's not even there when he gets convicted.
No.
That's crazy.
He's living it up in the south of France.
Yeah. Still, the pursuit raged on as DA fugitive and extradition chief Richard Benedetto was not satisfied to allow the verdict to stand without retribution.
Yeah, he actually said that a bunch of Ira's local friends in Philadelphia told him, there's no way you're going to catch him. He's just too smart for you. And hell hath no fury like an Italian man from Philly being challenged.
That's right. That's right. He tirelessly followed the trail and he hunted down Ira based on one single tip. He was directed to investigate Annika's whereabouts as a means to Ira.
Yeah. So what he did was actually looked into Annika's Swedish social security number and realized that she had applied for a French driving license under the name Annika Floden Mallon.
Ah, she took his fake name.
She took his fake name.
This proved to be a successful tip because Chief Benedetto was finally able to apprehend Ira in 1997 at his home in the Bordeaux region of France.
But things still wouldn't be so simple to ensure Ira would pay for his crime. Ira's lawyer argued that he could not be extradited to the U.S., where he could face the death penalty without even a chance to defend himself at a retrial. Which, by the way, it wasn't possible that he would face the death penalty, because it wasn't practiced in Pennsylvania at the time of his original trial, and state and federal constitutions prohibit the use of ex post facto law, which I presume means that you cannot bring in a punishment that wasn't in effect during the original trial. But my lawyer friends, you can call, text, completely berate me for that incorrect definition. And Ira did have something to say once he was apprehended.
The situation now is not yet clear, but I will make a declaration. I am innocent. I want a fair trial. I will be happy to go to the United States if a court gives me a new trial. Say tu. Thank you.
The stall tactic still continued over the course of 4 years, with Ira even attempting to unsuccessfully slit his own throat to avoid extradition. And Brian and I actually watched a very alarming video of him speaking about the socialist nature of France and how he should be protected by the prime minister with this gaping wound around his neck.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's
totally
disturbing.
You're interested, if you're a glutton for punishment, it is out there on YouTube. I have to say, this was the one time that I felt the least bit of sympathy for someone connected to Ira, because his lawyer who was there while he was giving this tirade looked terrified.
Oh, yeah.
But much to Ira's dismay, the extradition was carried out in 2001. And as an insider piece of information, my dad, who at the time was a police officer in Philadelphia, told me that Detective Chitwood, who originally had discovered Holly's body, was there at the airport to greet Ira when he was extradited back to the United States. I would have loved to seen what that meeting was like. He was probably like, "Welcome home, bitch." And in 2002... Ira was tried in front of a jury of his peers, where he continued to express all these conspiratorial theories of being framed. It was only another 2-hour deliberation, which delivered a guilty verdict, and from the judge, a quick, mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole. Annika, Ira's wife, was not there at the trial. She was actually advised not to go because she could have been arrested herself for harboring this man on the run, this guilty man. Although she did share her response to the verdict after it was released.
My first reaction came when I learned that the jury was back already. It went too quick. And that upset me a great deal because I felt, you know, this is not going to go well. The jury has not taken the time needed to really look into things. And then that, whatever half an hour it was before the actual verdict, was a very, very difficult moment. And I felt just so profound sadness when that verdict came down.
This just blows my mind because she acts like it was a one-and-done case that was wrapped up in a little bow. She said it took such a short period of time to deliver this guilty verdict. But in reality, it took how long? 25 years. From 1977 to 2002. It is absolutely crazy. Today, Ira still sits in a prison at Laurel Highlands State Correctional Facility. He's actually at a minimum security prison because apparently he's very old and decrepit. But he still is interested in engaging people in all of his thoughts. So if you're interested in writing to Ira, he is at the Laurel Highlands State Correctional Facility awaiting your letter. So that's it for our episode on Ira Einhorn, the Unicorn Killer.
Thank you all for listening.
Stay tuned for our episode 2 of The City of Brotherly Blood. This was a blast.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Lauren.
Talk to you next time.
See ya.